Sometimes in life, a typical day can take an unexpected turn. In the case of Mohamed Massaqua, a casual day riding ATVs with friends would change his life forever.
So I was involved in an ATV accident 2.5 years ago now, where I ended up losing my left hand. My ATV ended up flipping and my hand got crushed on impact, and they had to amputate it after 12 total surgeries. But you see hand get rebuilt, and then all of a sudden, over the course of probably like 3 weeks, you just see individual fingers start to get amputated for different reasons. But it's like, man, this is crazy. Like, I never had surgery planned for it. So my first surgery came after I was retired, and on an accident that, I expected it to be a normal day, and it was the furthest thing from a normal day. And you wake up one morning, you have 10 fingers, and then you wake up another morning, you have 6 fingers.
Also on this week's episode, we discuss how to process pain, keeping mind over matter, and staying consistent. And now, episode 24 of Culturation.
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
Are you ready? The main event of the evening.
The ideas.
It's the word that you put in.
The ability.
Can you dig it?
The talent.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
Those who influence, the entertainer, the business leader, and the entrepreneur, they're all right here on Culturation. And now, your host, Justin Epstein.
Welcome to Culturation. I'm your host, Justin Epstein. On this week's episode, we speak with the change manager, Mohamed Massaqua. A Charlotte, North Carolina native, Mohamed was the second round pick for the Cleveland Browns in the 2009 NFL Draft. Before joining the NFL, he earned a Bachelor of Science degree in psychology from the University of Georgia, where he was also named the 2008 team captain, selected as a first-team All-Southeastern Conference and academic All-SEC member. After retiring from the NFL, he worked as a financial advisor at Morgan Stanley. In the spring of 2017, while riding ATVs with friends, he was involved in an accident that resulted in the amputation of his left hand. Following the accident, he launched Vessel, a change management firm that guides companies through organizational change. Mohamed is a member of the 2018 UGA 40 Under 40 class and a graduate of the 2019 Harvard Business School's Program for Leadership Development, which is HBS's executive MBA alternative. And with that being said, I'd like to welcome my friend Mohamed Massaqua to the podcast. What's going on, man?
It's good. Pleasure to see you this morning.
Yeah, man. Appreciate it. Early on a Friday morning and dedicated, on time, ready to go.
Yeah. Try to get up, So good.
Love it, man. And for those that may not know, we were just talking before we got on, new baby, and you can touch on that later. So even more impressive that you're functioning this early with a newborn.
Yeah, we have her on a nice schedule. Give all the credit to my wife.
There you go, smart.
But I'm up early regardless.
I love it. So for those that may not know you or be familiar with your background, kind of give a little quick snippet of who you are, kind of what you do.
30,000 foot view, I guess. Born in Charlotte, North Carolina to immigrant parents. They're Liberian. Went to the University of Georgia, played football there. Was a second round pick for the Cleveland Browns. Story takes a really interesting turn where I became an amputee about 2 years ago, and now I transitioned into doing corporate change management work. So
nice, man.
All exciting.
So we got a lot to cover. So pretty much you grew up in Charlotte. How long kind of did you live there for?
Really my whole life.
Okay.
We took a short break when I was like kindergarten through third grade. We moved to Chicago.
Okay.
But Chicago was too wild. It was too cold. So my mom was like, all right, we're going.
Chicago winters are no joke, man.
And no joke.
So how'd you like growing up in Charlotte?
I loved it because it was it's a big city, but small city.
Yeah.
It's a lot of love. It's a lot of pride. It wasn't as transient. So people from Charlotte were actually from Charlotte, not like Atlanta where you got people from all over the place. In the hometown field of having like the Hornets
and yeah.
When the Panthers came to town, it was like all that, like it's just local pride, local love.
Yeah, so Charlotte now is booming though.
Oh, now it's wild.
Completely different city. Wow, man.
I get lost when I go home every time.
So when you grew up in Charlotte, what was there to do in Charlotte at that time? What were you kind of growing up? Were you playing sports at this time?
Yeah, I mean, we were just kids running wild. We'd get on our bike. So I'm a in-town kid. So, we could be downtown and just see like the activity that's going on. And the way Charlotte is, you can really bike to anywhere. And so we just leave in the morning, go bike. And as we got older, obviously you get into sports, you get involved in other things and your priorities change. But I mean, it was just a lot of fun. Just very adventurous, I'd
say. So how were you as a kid? Were you adventurous in that regard? Were you kind of to yourself? Were you outgoing?
Nah. I love being around people.
Okay.
Like, one of my favorite things to do is when I'm in big cities or different cities, I just like to walk the city and just like watch how people interact. So being adventurous, meeting people on different sides of town. And what's crazy is like all the inner city kids all played under the same youth sports league.
So okay.
If we would go to another side of town, we go play football or basketball there. If we go to another side of town, you know, we hang out, do something there. Or you got cousins that live on different sides of town, so you're hanging with their friends or whatever the case may be. This is like young.
Yeah.
And then as you get older, sports takes the cake and you're, you know, actually doing things with your teammates and you got a different set of friends and you're doing other stuff.
So what age did you start playing sports, and what was the first sport that you started playing?
I started playing in Chicago, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I started playing football because my older cousins played, and I actually wanted to play basketball.
Okay.
But, you know, you got to be like 6'5", 6'6", to play basketball. And one of my boys, he actually played on the Memphis team with Derrick Rose. We were the same height all the way up until like ninth grade summer, and then he shot up to 6'6", and I stopped growing at 6'1".
And that's when you said the dream's no longer real.
Yeah, I was like, it's probably makes more sense to go, you know, run around on this field than run around on this court.
Got it. So now you're kind of at this point still just a hobby, or are you looking at it at this age like you're getting into high school now, I assume?
Getting into high school. But this is before, like, the landscape was a lot different. This is before YouTube and social media, and you really didn't know like how you become a pro athlete, and nobody from Charlotte had become a pro athlete in, you know, basketball or football.
Yeah.
So it was just one of those things that we did for fun. It was like, oh, it would be cool to go to Carolina. It would be cool to go to, you know, Duke or something like that. But that correlation of like coming from the inner city hood to going to college just
didn't even seem real. Yeah,
it didn't even make sense.
So, a couple things. One, this is selfishly, I want to know, Duke or UNC?
Oh, Carolina all day.
Oh man, we need to stop this interview right now, man.
Duke is trash. The only thing good about Duke is Coach K. Like, he's a phenomenal person, phenomenal coach. But the rest of Duke is awful.
Listen, man, Duke is the greatest college basketball team of all time.
Now,
and Coach K is the man. So at least I'll agree with you on that one.
Yeah.
I'll agree with you on that one.
No, it's. I just love the fact that it's such a good rivalry.
It's an amazing rivalry.
My mom's actually a Duke fan.
Mom knows what's up, man.
Nah,
always listen to your mother, they say.
This is but just we would actually go take recruiting trips to Duke just to go watch Cameron Indoor Stadium just because it's such a great
such an amazing stadium,
100%.
So when you were coming up in Charlotte, did you grow up a Hornets fan?
Oh, of course.
Okay. And back then, I'm trying to think who used to be. Did Muggsy go at one point?
Muggsy's
Larry
there,
Johnson
Larry
came at
Johnson
one point.
There. Lonzo Mourning's
there. Yeah, that's right.
Curry's
great jersey,
there.
Man. They had phenomenal jersey. One 100%. Of the hardest jerseys in the league.
And that's the crazy thing about living in Atlanta, because everybody assumes you're a Hawks fan or a Falcons fan.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
Most people that live in Atlanta aren't even from Atlanta.
They're not from here.
Yeah.
So they got ties to wherever they're from.
Okay, so now you're coming up, you're playing ball, doing all that. Not really thinking about like the future at this point, just kind of like having a good time with your friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start getting into football about high school.
Yeah.
What position are you playing?
Receiver.
Okay. And is it something that's coming naturally to you? Do you work hard to kind of develop in it? You know,
it came naturally just because it was like kids now, they don't play outside. Like, that's all we did. So
yeah.
We were functional at just about every sport. But what sport you're actually going to focus in on, nobody knows, because, you know, I grew up playing quarterback and I grew up playing running back, not because those were the positions. It was just like, okay, you're athletic. You just go play there and we're going to give you the ball and you run around. And then you get to high school, and I fell into like a really interesting situation, because my high school team, the backdrop to that is that we won 177 games in a row. So I came in there as the streak was starting.
So you won 177 games in a row.
Yeah. And seven or eight straight championships. We had the longest public school win streak ever.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's crazy. So it wasn't one of those things where like you're just gonna come around here and just mess around. Like, you actually are either gonna contribute to the team or you're not gonna be on the team. And my coach was like, you're tall, you're long, you look like a receiver. So I was like, cool, you know.
So how did this program get so good though?
Tommy Knotts. He's won like 10 straight, or not 10 straight, but 10 or 11 state championships across maybe like four high school.
That's unbelievable.
Oh yeah, he's a rock star. He's doing the same thing in South Carolina now at like almost 60 years old.
To win though, like that's, so all 4 years, you never lost a game.
Mm-mm.
And you won a state championship every year.
Yeah.
Were you like blowing teams out?
Yeah, for sure. We had some interesting players like Chris Leak, who went to Florida. He won the national champion down there. Hakeem Nicks, he won the Super Bowl. So we had a lot of talented guys.
Yeah.
But we just, he knew how to see the talent. We didn't know how to see the talent.
Why do you think so much talent came out of there? Was it, in that regard, was it that much talent, or he just knew, like you said, how to unlock it?
I think he knew how to unlock it. I think he knew where guys were supposed to play, how guys were supposed to play. He knew, in his system, I mean, I think he's probably advanced for like how what he expects of his players.
Yeah.
You know.
So now, at what point in high school you're playing? I mean, you're doing pretty well, obviously, if the team is crushing everybody. At what point do you think to yourself, are you thinking, I want to go play ball in college? Is it even a reality in your mind at this point? Do you want to go do something else?
It becomes a reality seeing Chris, because Chris was the number one recruit in the country.
Yeah.
And so you got guys like Bobby Bowden coming down. You got Pete Carroll coming down. You got, you know, the who's who of whoever's coming down. And you're like, oh, shit, it, like, this is how this works.
Yeah.
You know, and going into my sophomore year, his senior year, you're traveling places with him, and you're kind of doing the eye test against other people, and you're like, okay, this person has a scholarship offer. I think I'm, you know, on par with them or a little bit better. I think if I stay on this journey, I'll be all right.
Yeah.
And then, you know, your time comes, and you're just like, oh, this is for real. And my mom, being West African and immigrating to this country, she had no idea of how scholarships worked. She had no idea of how sports worked in general. So she was like, you know, what's the catch?
And I was like, they're just going to hook you up?
There is no catch, hopefully, you know. And it all worked out.
That's crazy. So was there another option for you, or was this option A, B, and C?
See, that's the crazy thing, though, because my mom not paying attention to sports. Like, school came naturally to me just because she'd always ingrained, you know, you want to have your education, you want to have your education. So I would have gone to college somewhere, a really good college. How we would have paid for it, though, that still to be determined.
So why do you feel that you were able to balance that, though? Was it because of your mom educating you in the sense that, like, education is so important? Because you get a lot of student athletes,
mm-hmm.
and you become tunnel vision. All I want is sports, sports, sports. Education kind of becomes secondary.
Yeah.
And not because you don't care, just you're so focused on the goal ahead.
Mm-hmm.
How did you kind of keep the momentum to not let the education slip and at the same time perform at a high level?
Well, it's weird, man. I grew up in American, but I grew up raised African. So, like, just culturally, my view on, like, how the world works was more from, like, the West African, where education is important. And the fact that how my parents even got over here is that the Civil War broke out right as they were about to go into college.
Wow.
And they realized just, like, how their life changed without having that opportunity to go. So the focus was always to go to college, and sports just kind of blossomed as I got older. I never even made the correlation of, okay, yeah, it would be cool. You watch Jordan, you watch all these pro guys play, but you'd never really make the connection. You're like, okay, they were born to play sports.
Yeah.
It's just everybody else just kind of works to figure out how life works.
It's interesting. So, like, you kind of almost looked at it as, like, school in a sense to where it's, like, you just put in the work.
Yeah.
You're not really looking at, like, the glitz and glam. It's, like, just get it done and make it happen onto the next thing.
Yeah, for sure.
So, like, you score a touchdown, you probably aren't the type of guy that's sitting there doing victory dances.
Nah, it was just kind of a...
It was like, all right, I did it. It's what I was supposed to do.
Yeah, it was just kind of like a part of... And that's kind of... like that. I think that's what made Coach not so special, because it was such a team-oriented focus. It was, you know, we're all in this together. You might be the guy that's the high recruit. You might be the prized possession and other people. But here, we're all the same. Like, whether you're starting, whether you're not starting, whether you're the water boy, like, everybody's coming to work. And so just that mentality of, okay, like, I'm supposed to function at this level.
Yeah.
Just, that's what it is.
So, did your mom at this point, like, realize, like, you're getting pretty good and this is getting real?
Yeah, I think Coach Knox would be like, hey, feed the boy. Because, you know, like, he needs to look like he can actually play on the next level. People, I was super skinny. People, you know, coming. But in her mind, it was almost like a burden. Because it was like, why are these people calling? Why are these people bothering? Like, why? Like, what do they want? You know, like, I just don't want something to blow up in our face down the line. So I think that connection to this translates into that, and then translates into something else. I still don't think it even made sense to my mom to this day.
Wow. Do you think, though, that she's the one that's grounded you throughout this entire process?
Yeah, because you see, when you come, like, when you have to flee, like, a country, and you just, like, really in survival mode, you don't have the luxury of wasting time. You don't have the luxury of exploring options. You're just trying to do what's right for your family. And so in seeing how she had to move, how, you know, the sacrifices that she made, the work that she put in, it keeps me focused just to, you know, not take anything for granted.
Yeah.
The highs or the lows.
I mean, I think, you know, people don't realize how much, and I've spoken to so many people on this podcast, their upbringing and what they saw around them ingrained in kind of who they became, right? And parents, a lot of times, I don't feel like they realize, like, we're watching.
Mm-hmm.
And then how it actually translates into your decisions and kind of how you kind of evolve as an individual as you mature.
Yeah.
Very cool. So you're doing well in football now. You're seeing your teammates getting drafted number one. You're going, okay, wow, this is a real possibility. Best coaches in the world are flying in. Are you saying sophomore year, people starting to see you a little bit? When do you start to say, okay, I need to really start considering college and which college I'm going to go to?
Probably after my sophomore year, because that was the year so much attention was on Chris.
Yeah.
That was the year I came into, like, my own. And it was not fully, but, you know, you start to realize, all right, you know, people are paying attention. I'm getting scholarships offers of my own. And you're like, okay, now where does it make sense to go? You know, I've very limited exposure outside of North Carolina, really very limited exposure outside of the area I grew up in. So you're looking and you're like, okay, wow, you know, I could go to Cal. I could go to Texas. I could go to Michigan. I could go to Ohio State. I could go to Florida. I could go to Miami. And you're just like, well, I don't even know what those places look like. I don't even know how I'm going to get there. I don't know how I'm going to get home. And I remember talking to my mom where I was considering Texas because Mac Brown was the coach of North Carolina. He went to Texas. And she was like, man, you know, I'm going to be honest with you. If you go out there, you like, I don't know how I'm going to get out there because I can't afford it. I don't know how you're going to get home. So I was just like, damn, you know, where do I go so my mom could see me play, you know, my family could see me play. And also, if things get sideways, I can actually get back to it.
You That's know. Crazy, man. So you're really, I mean, it's bigger. It's not just as simple as a decision of like, I want to go to California or I want to go to Texas. Like, you've got to take real life consideration stuff into this.
Yeah, because, I mean, you don't know how things are going to work out. You may hate the place.
Yeah.
Or something may happen back home where you actually have to get back home. And if you're halfway across the country, and a lot of these individuals, I don't want to stereotype, but they're coming from environments to where their background doesn't support just like air travel
or
last minute decision making if something happens. So you have to factor that in. And even if it's a great time, you want to come back home in times that you just want to be home around your support system.
Do you think that the wide receiver position you did well into because of like the studying and the routes and all this stuff, like it required homework and kind of thought process?
At that level...
Or you're just like, I know I can run, I can catch, I can do what I need to.
Some of it is like the talent that's around you. I mean, I played with the number one quarterback in the country, so that
they make you better, I'm sure.
They make you better. Some of it is youthful ignorance that where you don't know you're as good or as bad as you are, but you're just confident, so you know you proceed like you're supposed to be there. Some of it is not some, a lot of it is you actually put the work in. You know.
Yeah.
Like those days of running around in the middle of the street, you know, playing football, like all those are reps that other people might have been playing video games, or, you know, the times where you're riding your bike across the city, like that's conditioning, whether you realize it or not.
But yeah.
Just being in the hot sun, running around, period, or lifting weights or doing the things that other people are willing to do. So it's like the culmination of all of that stuff where you're just like, okay, I've put in the work in ways that I don't know. And when we get here, you know, I feel like I'm supposed to be here.
So now you get to your senior year, right? And things are starting to really now, I'm sure, got to make a decision.
You got to make a decision.
What are the top schools that are coming to you, and are you having a struggle determining which one you're going to go to?
For sure, because what's tricky, obviously, Georgia's the best. That's where I went. But a lot of these schools are premier programs to where that you get all of the above. You get the great athletic experience, you get the great academic experience, you get the great social experience, you get the great alumni experience, like all of it. And when you're, gosh, 15 through 18, like your mind changes as the wind blows. So as you're looking at, man, Texas looks really good, LSU looks really good, Florida State looks really good, everything starts to look the same.
Yeah.
And then at that point, you just make a gut decision. Yeah. Hopefully you make the right decision, you know, or you turn it into the right decision when you get there, but it's not easy.
Yeah.
It becomes, this is completely a first world problem, but it becomes burdensome, like the luxury of riches that you have to choose from.
Yeah, no, I mean, I could definitely see that. I mean, sometimes too much is way overwhelming. It's a lot easier when it's like you have one or two choices. Mm-hmm. But when you have 15 schools or 10 schools, how do you make the right decision, right? It's exactly what you're saying. I can go to this school and I can hate it. Mm-hmm. And now I just screwed up my chance going to another school. Or so, I mean, it's a lot for a young kid too. And it didn't seem, you know, sometimes it's, I feel, you know, I played collegiate sports, but I feel, especially in NFL or, football or basketball, you get a lot of pressure from the family too of like where they think you should go.
Yeah.
And that's tough on a kid when you're 16, 17 years old because your parents still influence kind of your thought process. How much of a role did your mom play as far as you deciding, you know, this is the best decision for us as a whole?
She didn't really care, honestly.
And I feel like that's what, but that's what I feel was probably the best thing out of all this, right? Yeah. Is that there was no outside, you already have enough pressure.
Yeah.
So to not have to have it from your parent who just wants to see you happy probably makes the process, not saying easier, but a little bit more enjoyable.
She just made sure the metrics that I was measuring the school by were accurate. Like, Adidas versus Nike, like, that shouldn't be the decision. Like, what color they are shouldn't be the decision. Like, just the dumb stuff that you may look at.
When but these are things that people look at.
Yeah, you're like,
oh, you're like, man. Oregon's got the dopest jerseys.
Oregon has the dopest jersey. Oh, my God, you guys have, like, food at your disposal over here. And it's like, is that really what you should measure this by? So it was one of those things where she was like, you go where you go, I'm going to support you. You know, if you're happy, I'm happy. So,
that's amazing, man.
Yeah.
So what made you decide to commit to Georgia?
A lot of it was comfort. A lot of it was Georgia or Athens to Charlotte is like 2 hours 45. Premier program. The access to Atlanta, which is big. A lot of people don't think, like, will I actually want to go back to college after I leave? You know, if you go to Nebraska or something, like, how realistic that I'm going to be in Nebraska or Kansas at any point again in life? They had two senior receivers leaving, so it would have meant that I would have been coming in early with the expectation to play. And ironically, one of the things that actually put Georgia on my radar was my high school quarterback ended up getting an offer, a guy named Joe Cox. And we thought it'd be cool if we could go to school together. I didn't want to go to Florida with Chris. Not because of Chris, but just I didn't want to go to Florida. And we were like, okay, this if it makes sense, you know, I'll strongly consider it. And it made sense. It checked every box, and it worked out really well.
So you really did your homework.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Because the academic side of it, like, led way to was like, okay, I want to have a good experience both ways.
Yeah.
And I can kind of, like, I understand, like, I know what I'm looking for here. And if it doesn't hit a certain checkbox or, if, like, the integrity part, like, there were some things that you'd see early on that had nothing to do with football. It was just the people that you'd be around and you're like, I don't know if I want to, you know, spend 4 years with this individual here.
Or, yeah.
You know, I saw how so-and-so got done. I don't want to, you know, have that potentially happen to me if something happens.
Wow. All right. So, you know, it's interesting. The one thing that you said, I never thought about when I even was, like, looking in for recruit trips. You go to school because you're like, this school is going to be amazing. It's going to be a great experience. But the fact that you thought about, is this a city that I can potentially stay in after for a career?
Yeah.
Most people don't think about that. That's actually a very valid point.
Because you, like...
It's almost seen as like a temporary living situation when you go away.
Yeah. And there's like not a knock on certain places, but there were certain schools that called and I was like, you know, I don't want to physically be in that state, you know, just because of like the perception of what's going on in that state. I don't even want to put myself to that. Or you see some schools and you're like, man, that environment right there just doesn't make sense. Or that is so far that realistically, like, do I actually want to call that the place that I'm going to be at? And then you see certain places, you're like, all right, this... I get a good vibe from here. I like the city. I like the town. I like everything that surrounds it. I like the people, you know. And then the other stuff, you kind of make it your own.
So you end up going to Georgia.
Went to Georgia.
What is the feeling when you strap up for your first game?
I mean, it was exciting. We played Boise State, and Boise was a good team. And you get in, and you're like, dang, you know, my high school probably we sit 4,000, 5,000 people, and then all of a sudden you're in front of 95,000 people.
Yeah, it's got to be crazy.
You're like, oh my God. You just look around and you try to take it all in. And that game, you're sitting in there as a fan and as a player at the same time. Like, it's like for those first few games, it's hard to make that switch because it's still surreal. Like, you go and you're watching this stuff on TV and you're watching these people at a high level, and then all of a sudden you're a part of the event.
Yeah.
And that connection is just oh my God, this is crazy.
So how'd you do your first year?
First year was good.
Okay.
I broke into the starting lineup like week five or something like that.
Were you expecting to?
Once again, like that young ego, like young bliss, you know, to where you're like, okay, you know, I think I come here and play early, play well. And if I do that, I think I got a real shot to perform. And that ended up happening. And, you know, it was exciting. It was exciting.
And then from that point on, you're kind of like get a taste of it now. You don't want to let that slot go.
Nah, you don't want to. Because then what happens is that, like, just like you see the dream of becoming like a college athlete happen, then you see the first draft class. And you're just like, oh, jump. Like, you know, we used to catch the recreational bus together in college. And now this guy just became a second round pick. Or, oh my God, you know, we used to, you know, try to scrape change together for $5 pizza at Papa John's. And now this individual, or like, this is what the hard work pays off can do. Like, you see your friends and stuff and they're on TV and you're just like, oh, like, it's real now. Like, you know, if you stay the course, it's super real.
What's crazy though, that I find fascinating about you, man, which is funny, is that you get into college, you go to UGA, and you still don't even seem kind of like when you were in high school, you're not like, I want to go play pro.
You do, you just don't, you don't know.
But you weren't already set in that way of like, I'm definitely going to be a pro. Like, this is the future. You went in there like, this may happen, but
you just don't know. Like, it's almost like people expect the thing that they dream to just, the universe just like opens up.
Yeah.
Like there's so much stuff that has to line up to happen.
Yeah.
Like,
people don't see the behind the scenes stuff.
They don't see the behind the scenes.
They just think you get into the college program like UGA and the next thing you know, you're guaranteed to be a top round one or two pick.
Exactly. And it's like, nah.
And most guys don't. I mean, how many, what is it, like 90 on a squad?
Yeah. Like 90 on a squad. And each year, maybe at a place like Georgia, maybe five get drafted, and that's like Georgia's number three team in the country.
Yeah.
At a place like Alabama,
maybe so seven. The odds are pretty low.
Oh, they're low. But and if you're at a school that's not one of those premier programs, you may have two guys get drafted. Like, that's a phenomenal year.
Yeah. That's crazy. So, you know, do you feel like humbling yourself in the regard of like the reality of the situation is what kept you consistent?
I think it's more so like that, the African side of me,
yeah.
To where you just understand the context of
you, like, never take it for granted
how you got here.
Yeah,
you know, where you're watching like footage of people losing their lives, and you're watching like a country that got 3 million people lose a half a million people over the span of, you know, 5-10 years or whatever.
Puts things in perspective real quick.
It puts things in perspective, so you're like, things could go sideways.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that means. It could go left all the way. And so I just want to make sure that I'm doing everything that I need to do to put myself in this position, but I just don't know how it's going to shake out.
Yeah. Mm. So as far as your experience in Georgia, you go, football's going well.
Mm-hmm.
What did you end up studying on the academic side?
Psychology. Yeah.
Why psychology?
I'm just fascinated with how people move, and how it's just always been like.
It seems like this since childhood, right? Like, you watch people, like you said, just as you're on your bike walking around, it just has always instilled a fascination within you.
Yeah, and I didn't know it at the time. I didn't even know what I was going to do with it. Like, I kind of read the description of it, and I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. When you take a couple of intro classes, you're like, it's cool. But you don't really know. I didn't want to be like a shrink or nothing like that. But it's just like, this is fascinating. Like, this is something that I do naturally. It's just in a much more unrefined version.
Wow. So when you get into it, you take the first two prerequisites, but then you realize, all right, there's something here for a bigger, I actually want to major in this.
I want to major in it, but, and I think this is where it starts to get kind of muddy, because now you're like, okay, I think I got a shot to play pro, but then I have to leave out of here with a degree, you know, and I'm fascinated with that. But what do I do with the degree? Because now the dream is starting to become more real that you could become a pro. So
very rarely do I ever hear anybody in the sports world say, I'm having a hard time staying in school versus going pro.
No, not to that regard, but it's like the focus of what you're in school for.
Yeah.
Like the focus of, yes, you're in class and you get these degrees and you get good grades, all that stuff. But now it's like, okay, being here at Georgia allows me to accomplish like this other dream that is way more real than what potentially this degree has to offer. So as you're thinking about the degree, you're not necessarily thinking about what you want to do with it because you're thinking about what you actually want to do is play professional football. So that's where it's just like you're in school, but your agenda in school probably isn't like the other students on campus because you're trying to get to the pros.
Yeah. So now you have a good 4 years at Georgia. Mm-hmm. You're getting a lot of buzz from the people that I've spoken to that are UGA fans that know your name. You were one of probably the most liked players of all time at UGA. And why is that? Why did people like gravitate towards you so much? Because, I mean, I've spoken to a lot of people, and your name unanimously like puts smiles and positivity on people's faces.
Maybe because it's so unique, my name is. Maybe because they like saying it. I don't know.
But it seems like you were just an exciting player that people enjoyed to watch.
I mean, I had a good time. I had a good time. There's definitely moments that I had some really good plays. There's some plays that I wish I could have got back to, you know, turn into big plays.
Yeah.
But I think at the end of the day, I think anybody that's Georgia-related knew that I cared about it. I cared about my teammates. I had a good time while there. There wasn't any crazy, like, backstory that's ever going to come out. It was just almost like just thankful to be there. You know, just thankful to have that opportunity. It's not as easy as people may think, especially when you're coming from like the backgrounds that a lot of people come from.
So yeah.
It was just like that, man, this is wild. I'm like literally here at Georgia, you know, and I get a chance to like run around. Something that I used to do in the middle of the street, and like we'd pause the game as cars were driving by and we'd re-engage. And now you're playing in front of 97,000 people.
Crazy.
And this is normal life now, but it's far from normal.
You know? But you were able to separate it, which is what's interesting, right? Like you were able to, unless maybe not then, but now you definitely can.
Now I can separate
back it. Back then, were you able to?
No.
It's very blurry, right?
It's very blurry. You're just, because you're in it, but you don't feel like you're in it because you're just like, this is crazy.
Yeah.
Like, this is super wild. Like I am like literally here playing football.
You're like, I'm inside Madden.
Yeah, like I'm inside Madden. Like I would watch my dad play. They'd always have like whenever the Liberian Independence Day would come, they'd have like all these people that they'd go to like the local parks in Charlotte and they'd be playing. And then you're like, that's like the closest thing of professionalism that you saw. Like they were all big time in Liberia where they were coming from. And then the people that played, you know, for the Panthers or something, you're just like, okay, like Julius Peppers is 6'7",
big boy, man,
300 pounds. And you see him and you're just like, oh shit, I'm not 6'7", 300 pounds, you know? So then when you're part of that, you're just like, man, this is crazy. Like, this is crazy. You
know? So what year in school, is it sophomore, junior, senior that you're like, all right, I think I may go to the NFL. Like, this is a true reality.
You know, kind of. But because you're always sizing yourself up against other people, like I kind of move like him.
So statistically, like him. You could kind of evaluate it.
And then I had a really good senior year, so you're like, okay,
good time to turn it on.
Good, like really good time. So you're like, okay, I don't know where, but I know I'm gonna be in there somewhere. Like I don't know where, but I know I'm in there somewhere. Like after you agents start reaching out to you, financial advisors start reaching out to you, people, it's almost like the recruiting.
All over again.
So you're like, okay, this should work out. All right.
So you start getting calls.
Yeah.
There start comes interest, right? And the season ends. What do you start doing at this point? Are you prepping now? Are you
the last game we played Michigan State down in Orlando, when I left the locker room, I was in a car headed to Pensacola, Florida to start training. Like the turnaround was, you know, you say bye to everybody, and the next morning I was in Pensacola, Florida.
And are you there? Is that the combine at this point, or
is where you train to prepare for the combine?
Got it.
Prepare for everything.
And this is you doing this. This is just kind of how the industry works.
It's really how it works.
Like, got it.
You get caught up to speed because I mean, there's no manual to become a athlete.
You just, so how do you even learn this stuff?
You hopefully got an agent that is going to kind of school you to what's going on,
and guide you on all this,
or you have players that go before you that they can kind of coach you through the situation.
So then you go, you train, and then you get ready, and the combine is when they kind of, all the scouts, the teams look at you and say, okay, this is somebody that we want to look at potentially drafting.
Yeah, so you do the combine, and then you do the pro day.
Okay.
And then you have private workouts for teams that either have a lot of interest or they kind of play like chess moves, they throw like smoke screens or whatever. So you go through all that. The combine's first. You do that depending on how you perform at the combine, determines on what you need to test on at your pro day. You still go through all these different workouts because you have all 32 teams that are actually like laser focused just on what you're doing. And then after that, you may have different position coaches or offensive coordinators that want to see you just one-on-one. And that's over, gosh, our last game, let's just say January 1. And that's from January 1 to about, let's just say April 15th or something.
You know? Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah, and then the draft is at the end of April.
So you have to perform at like the highest level for like a 4-month period. Like really, if you're gonna like put it out, like you got to be on it.
100%.
How did you perform at combine? Did you do pretty well?
Nah, what's crazy at the combine? We prior to that, there's a senior bowl, and ended up rolling my ankle at the senior bowl, and so it was like a 3-week window where I couldn't train, I couldn't run, I got heavy, all that stuff. And I was like, damn. And then you try to perform at the combine and you run slower than you need to and all that stuff. And you're like, all right, I had to cut weight. I got to do this. I got to do that. Because the next time at the pro day, I got to make sure that what I was supposed to do at the combine,
yeah,
I actually do that. So it's stressful.
Was there a moment during that process from January to April where you did something or performed in a certain way where like, that is what I needed? Like, that's going to put me on the map?
Now, a lot of it, like at that point, you're really going off film.
Got it.
You're either verifying what they saw on film or you're showing some type of red flag.
Got it.
Like, you don't see guys just like not perform well on film and then just move up completely.
Yeah.
Unless they run like a 4.2 or something like that.
So you have more of a chance to go like regress, to go backwards, than you do to advance from the film?
You
just want to stay consistent.
You want to stay consistent. Okay. Honestly, you want to make sure like when this person sees you with their eyes, that they trust what they saw on film. Like they trust those highlight plays that they saw on film. So you're basically trying to validate the highlight plays that you put out there and not make them second question like the play that you might have loved, yeah, or the play that you might have had a drop, or the play you threw an interception or missed a tackle or something like that. Like that's what you're really trying to do. You're trying to say, okay, under the right environment, I'm gonna have more of these highlight plays than the other stuff that might have happened that didn't go so well.
Got it. Mm-hmm. So then draft day comes up.
Yeah.
Do you remember what you're thinking on that day?
You don't think any, like, it's so stressful because the way it worked there is that they had.
Because this was what year that you're.
This is 2009.
Okay.
And I think the first two rounds were on the same day and then the third through the seventh on the next day. And you don't know, like, where you're going to go.
Yeah.
And if you make it, if you don't go the first day and you get into the second day, you start questioning, like, all right, you know, what's going on? And then you see certain guys go ahead of you or not, and you're just like,
damn. Mentally, it's got to be crazy. Like,
mentally, yeah. You know. And then the other part of that is that you have a phone and everybody's calling your phone. Like, friends are calling, hey, what are you hearing? You know, random people that you don't even know have your number, what are you hearing? And you're like, bro, like, I'm waiting on a call in my life.
Like, yeah, you're like, this is not the time.
This is not the time. So literally you're just sitting there waiting.
And then you finally get the call.
You get the call. And they're like, hey, Mr. Massaquah, this is, you know, so-and-so from the Cleveland Browns. You know, what do you think? And I had never even been to Cleveland. I didn't know what Cleveland was. And I was like, yeah, you don't even have to say nothing. Just, you know, I'm there. You know.
So you finally hear your name get said.
You finally hear your name and then you see your name come across the screen.
And that's when life changes.
And that's when life changes.
Where you just sitting there and just like, surreal, like you the culmination,
like a you almost freeze because, yeah, you're just like,
I mean, your life changes overnight.
Overnight, like literally overnight, it changes. Like, you know, it literally overnight. You just go from amateur, you go to pro. You're like, just like that.
And you went second round, right?
Second round, pick 50.
I mean, that's a high pick still.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can't even imagine how stressful it is going into the second round. I mean, some of these guys that go 1, 2, and 3, they must have the weight of the world on their shoulders, man.
Because now this is where it changes.
Because everybody's got eyes on them.
Everybody knows it.
Correct.
And so while you you don't even process it before other people process how they're going to be a part of your life.
That's crazy.
And that's where you see a lot of guys where people think that they're quiet or they're stuck up or they're whatever. And it's just that they're
overwhelmed probably, man.
Like they just want to be normal, but they always have a lens of who's out to get me or who's, you know, trying to leverage something or who's angling. So you just move differently at that point.
So you end up going to Cleveland.
Going to Cleveland.
Right. Program that has been evolving over the years. This year, though, man,
that's the best way I've ever heard it put.
Well, I want to be respectful, but you know, listen, I'm a Jets fan.
Yeah, see, y'all been evolving too.
Yeah, I've been evolving for a long time. But you know, now you got people like OBJ, and you got all this stuff going on where that program's solid right now. They're looking strong.
Yeah.
Where you know, and I think also you had LeBron go back a few years ago, so. Ohio is really blowing up right now with like, it's kind of like Charlotte, a city that's definitely evolving and growing and building and becoming, you know, always. I love the city though from a sports angle because they're always dedicated to their sports teams.
100%.
I would always rather play in a city like a New York or a Cleveland where whether you win or lose, they're still coming out.
Oh, 100%.
Versus, you know, these wishy-washy, like, if you're winning, they come through. If not, they don't.
Cleveland rides hard for their people.
Like, they do, man.
People from Cleveland? People from Ohio.
Yeah.
People from Ohio have so much pride.
It's great. I'll tell you, Ohio and Pittsburgh are two places that I see people that are through and through solid, great people and are die-hard about their teams.
Die-hard. Like, you're not going to say nothing bad about a Cleveland Browns fan.
No.
Like, they may talk internally just out of frustration.
Yeah.
But you will not say anything bad about a Cleveland Brown fan.
That's amazing.
They will like put their life on the line, the pride that they have in their cities and their team.
So you now play in the NFL.
Now playing the NFL.
What's the advancement from college to pro? Like, is it a completely different level?
And physically, somewhat. Mentally, a lot. Like, physically, you can perform on a level with a lot of people. You don't know what you're doing. So you have to like just get caught up to speed on just the way of the world and how it works, the techniques and different things like that. But you start to gather that. The mental part to where now you're in a locker room with people that got kids, they got families, they got mortgages, they got taxes, they got like all like life stuff that just hadn't even crossed your radar because, you know, the least of your concern in college was, you know, paying bills or anything like that. Or getting traded or getting cut. So just the mental stress of what's actually starting to happen in life now changes because people think you're just an athlete. No, you're part of a business. You're part of an entity.
Yeah.
And you're expected to do certain things or they replace you.
You know? So, there's no 4-year guarantee. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So you see your first guy get cut and you're just like, damn, he wasn't even doing anything wrong. Like,
yeah.
I thought he was doing all right. And they cut him and he leaves on a black bag and now he has to go tell his family that.
That's crazy.
You know, this dream is over forever.
So every time you feel like you start to get to a point where you're like, I make it.
You never really make it.
If anything, it's more pressure. It's more responsibility. It's more, you've got to perform.
You got to perform. No one cares about, you know, your dog died. No one cares about, you know, you had an argument with your wife. Nobody cares about, you know, your mom, your cousin. Like, on Sunday, we expect you to do this. You know,
wow.
And that just because there's so many talented people that could literally do the job.
Yeah.
So many talented people that want the opportunity.
So you're at the Browns for how many years?
4 years.
Okay. And during the 4 years, I mean, how was your experience overall?
It was interesting just because we were so dysfunctional. We went through an ownership change. We went through 2 head coaches, multiple offensive coordinators, 7 quarterbacks. So it was just like...
You never really got settled.
You never really get settled because it's so chaotic. And then my second year, I suffered a real big concussion that starts to change the trajectory of my career. So you're battling trying to stay healthy. You're battling, you know, how long am I actually going to play now? So there's like a lot more factors that kind of come into just like the pure love of playing the game.
So when you have your first concussion, are you just like, hey, it's part of the game? Is it an eye-opening experience? Like, what is your mindset after that? Because some people, I mean, they have multiple concussions throughout their career. Some people, you're seeing guys now, like, who was it just retired at 29? Andrew Luck.
Andrew Luck, yeah.
I mean, gave up like $500 million and people are saying, why would you walk away from that? But he's like, I care about my health.
I mean, you're people, we're still human at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And my concussion was actually the one that changed, like, the way concussions were viewed just because it was such a big one.
Really?
It was actually the Sports Illustrated cover.
Really?
Yeah. And
what was so interesting about yours?
it was just so violent, and like
the
recovery time from it was so long. It was like a massive hit. So when you're recovering from something like that, you're like, damn, I've never felt anything like this before.
It shakes you.
It shakes you. And then you get another one, and then you get another one, and you get another one. And the recovery and the length of time is a lot different. And this is when literature is starting to come out about the impacts of concussions and everything. And you're just like, oh, wow, this isn't just like, you know, running up and down a court, and, you know, you got to replace knees at the end of the day.
Yeah.
You might not be wired the same way at the end of the day.
Wow.
You continue down this path.
After you had the first one, though, you said that was the second season.
Yeah, that was in my second season.
So when you came back, did you experience another concussion at some point?
In my third season, and then I got two in my... Wait. I got two in my third season. Then I got another one in my fourth season.
Wow.
Yeah, so you, like...
And now you're like, this is at the point where you're like...
Yeah.
I don't know how much longer this makes sense.
Yeah, I don't know how much longer this makes sense. Like, I'll play until I can't play anymore, and then you see, like, my fifth year, like, I could just see the desire to get hit at that level isn't the same. The recovery time from certain things aren't the same. You change, like, how you perform as a player, and you just, you can't perform at the level that you need to, so you're just like, all right.
I have to assume mentally it throws you off, too, because now, like, you don't mind going up for a catch and getting hit when you first started.
Yeah.
Now it's got to be in the back of your head.
It's in the back of your head that you don't want to get hurt.
Yeah.
And it's in the back of your head that this thing that I was going to do probably for 10, 12 years, now I'm probably only going to do for 5. And so you're 28-ish, you know, 27, 28-ish.
Yeah.
You know, you're just like, damn, you know, I'm still super young. You know, like, what do I actually want to do now? You know?
Are the two positions I would assume that probably deal with the most concussions have to be wide receiver and quarterback, I would assume.
Actually, it's weird because running backs get hit all the time.
Yeah.
Offensive linemen, they're getting hit. They're probably taking the most hits.
That's true.
Because they're banging with defensive linemen.
They're just not as, like, they're not out there. Violent, right, yeah.
You know? Linebackers are banging their head all the time. You know, the people that are probably the safest are corners.
Really?
Because they can control their impact.
Yeah, they're going to make the hit, if anything.
Yeah, like, that's probably the safest position on the field. Because if you're safety, you have to get involved in the action.
I mean, it's definitely an area that, you know, the NFL has taken a lot of challenges with, but they're looking, it seems like, on advancements for helmets and other things to kind of solve that situation at hand.
They can't solve it. It's like G-forces. If you hit one thing and it goes the other way, like, even if the helmet was, you know, made of cotton and you couldn't hit, like, once your brain gets triggered back and it bangs inside your skull, there's nothing you can do about that. And I don't know how they replace that.
Wow.
And athletes are just getting bigger, stronger, faster.
I mean, there are some insanely talented big athletes and fast athletes.
You know, you get a guy like Aaron Donaldson at 290, whatever he is, 280, and he runs a 4.5, 4.6.
That's unbelievable. Like, are you unbelievable, man. Like,
come on, for real?
Jeez. So you go through the first 5 years with Cleveland, and then you start to realize, okay, maybe – this is not what I want to continue doing. Not that you don't want to continue doing it as a passion and what you love doing, but
it just doesn't make the sense. It doesn't make sense to do it anymore.
And at this point, you know, you've had a career, you've made money, you've done some things, you've performed at the highest level. When do you start thinking, okay, I may exit now?
After that fifth season.
Yeah.
You're looking at it and you're like, gosh, I just don't. I know that there's a high possibility that I can get another concussion. I don't know what that looks like 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 30 years from now, 50 years from now, you know. And this is like when all the CTE stuff is starting to come out, and you're just like damn. Like, you love, it's like your baby that you have to give away.
Yeah. It's tough, man. I mean, you do something your whole life, and then you're just supposed to stop.
Yeah.
And I always find that, you know, Well, I can only say this because I played sports and not even to that degree. I remember stopping and it was like, what do I do with myself? Like, this is kind of how I've been identified. This is kind of how I was known. This is what I loved. Yeah. And then it's just gone.
They say athletes go through two deaths. Like, your physical death and then the death of leaving your sport.
Yeah.
And that's what whether you're pro or whether it happens at the end of high school, whether, because it's the failed reality of what else do you do?
Yeah.
There's like a negative connotation with being an athlete, but I love being an athlete. I love being in the locker room. I love performing. I love all that. Where can you go do that now? You can't spend your whole day basically being a kid and playing a game. You know?
That's crazy, man. So then you end up leaving the NFL.
Leaving the NFL.
And what do you do?
So the first, like, probably 6 months, 8 months, it was just, like, trying to figure it out, trying to process it. And then I had some friends that were in tech, and they were doing some different things in tech. I was like, okay, this is an interesting industry. But it just really made no sense to me. Like, there were apps that didn't make money. There were people that were just creating products. And
so, evaluating them at $5 billion with no revenue.
Yeah, and you're like, man, this is wild. Like, I have no interest in learning how to code. I don't really have a product that I'm trying to create. So after probably like a year of that, it was like, all right, you know, this isn't really like an industry that I really want to be in this capacity. Maybe as an investor, but like being active in it day to day is not something I want to do. And then I went to Morgan Stanley as a financial advisor. And that was interesting to me just because so many athletes go broke. And I was like, okay, personally, I want to understand this for myself. Like,
very smart, yeah.
But then I got a lot of friends that I know are getting squeezed the wrong way. Maybe if you don't work with them directly, you can at least give them some type of solid advice so that they know what they're looking for. And going from like the dynamics of sports to like the wild, wild west of tech, and then going into like the corporate world, it's just like,
it's a whole evolution, man.
It's a whole evolution. It's just like, man, people like, you know, great company, great things that they do. But for me, in the background that I was coming from, I needed something a little bit different.
Yeah.
And so while I was there, it was like a wrestle. Like, okay, like, what's next? You know, like, what do I want to do now?
But it seems like, you know, in a short period of time, let's say a year, 2 years there, right, as you're kind of trying these things, you kind of, though, at least tested the marketplace for interest levels. Because you went to tech, right, and startup world, which is one culture.
Yeah.
Then you went to corporate America and finance at the highest level with the Morgan Stanley. And I think, you know, I never realized, but after speaking with friends that have been in the industry, you know, agents and sports, I was blown away by the amount of athletes that financially go through all their money. And so kind of going and educating yourself on that space, which not even to kind of make money off your friends, but like you said, I just want to better educate people or try to advance so they're not getting squeezed, is admirable as can be. But then you realize, okay, well, cool, I've learned a little bit, but it's not me. So you're kind of using this trajectory to see what you don't like versus more what you do like in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you don't figure it out on the sideline. You got to play in traffic. Like, cause you.
What a great, by the way, I'm going to use that as your quote on our little creative part. That was good, man.
All right, because it's like you can do all the research, but unless you're actually in it, you don't get into like the weeds and the minutiae. Like you, in tech, like it looks really sexy.
Yeah.
There's like people that are crushing it, and then there's people that have been working on the same product for 10 years that have never come to light.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you see one out of like a million that hit.
A million.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody else is just kind of figuring it out. And then, like, you hear terms of I'm an entrepreneur, I'm an investor. That doesn't mean successful entrepreneur, successful investor.
Truest thing ever.
In the space.
Yeah.
And so once, like, you peel the covers back from all that sexiness, you're just like, boy, this is a crazy world. Like, you actually got to have something that you're so passionate about or something that, like, you're willing to, like, commit your life to. And I didn't have that. So I was like, okay, I need to figure this out. And then with Morgan Stanley, the experience that I needed to get out of it, I got out of it. And then once I got that experience, I was like, okay, I kind of know how all this stuff works. I know what makes sense if somebody asks me. The value that I could possibly provide, I don't think is the greatest impact here. Now, I got to figure out what that is. And then as we're kind of moving into like when my accident happened, that was around the time I was really wrestling. Okay, but what's next? Like what's next? What do I need to kind of own and put on my agenda to go pursue?
Got it. So the Morgan Stanley, you get what you need out of it. You move on. Now you're in kind of this discovery period of what's next.
No, I was still at Morgan Stanley.
You were still at Morgan Stanley.
Yeah,
and when you're at Morgan Stanley, is this when the accident you just referenced happened?
Yeah.
Okay. And for those that may not be familiar about what you're even referring to, kind of, can you tell a little bit about that?
So I was involved in an ATV accident 2.5 years ago now, where I ended up losing my left hand. My ATV ended up flipping and my hand got crushed on impact, and they had to amputate it after 12 total surgeries. But, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, so you see hand get rebuilt, and then all of a sudden, over the course of probably like 3 weeks, you just see individual fingers start to get amputated for different reasons.
Man.
Yeah.
This is crazy. During this time, I mean, I almost look at it as like you referenced earlier, like when you go to UGA for the first time, you're looking up and you're like, this is surreal. This isn't even real. Yeah. Are you going through that same kind of emotion at this point?
100%. But it's like, man, this is crazy. Like, I never had surgery playing sports.
Yeah.
So my first surgery came after I was retired, and on an accident that, you know, I expected it to be a normal day, and it was the furthest thing from a normal day. And you wake up one morning, you have 10 fingers, and then you wake up another morning, you have 6 fingers. And one of my neighbors, she had a pretty traumatic situation. She was like, probably two of the most unnatural things to have happen is to lose a body part that you came into this world with and to lose a child that you brought into the world. Like, that's just not supposed to happen.
Yeah.
And so as you try to process, like, even I look down in my hand now, it's like, damn, I used to have fingers that could do certain things.
Yeah.
And, you know, now.
You never really get used to it.
No. You, there's something to remind you every day that it is what it is. And you may cope with it differently, but you'll never forget it.
Yeah.
You'll never, like, adjust to it.
So when you go through this experience, right, and you now lose these fingers, now kind of starts that process where it's like, how do I work through this?
Yeah.
And how did, like, was it friends and family? Was it just taking time to yourself to reflect? Because I'm sure there's a lot of people you always hear that go through a lot of traumatic stuff, but some people don't know how to process it. Some people don't talk about it. Everybody's kind of goes through it and solves it, and you hope in some regard in different ways. What was kind of your way? And I say it's important because I feel like there's somebody else that's going to go through something of this nature.
100%.
And they need to have some sort of catalyst or understanding for you're able to get through it. Shit's not going to be easy.
Mm-hmm.
But what was that for you?
The best piece of advice that I got is that you got to feel it. And a lot of times you don't want to feel the trauma. You don't, like, you want to function in that state of shock. It's human nature to protect yourself. You don't want to make the weight of whatever just happened as real as it is. Like, most people don't want to go through that. And then once you let loose and you actually go through it, and it's painful, it's tough, like, you hit rock bottom in some regards, that's when you actually can start to build up, because you've gone through the range of emotions that your body wants to go through that you've been protecting yourself from. And then you know what you're trying to heal from. Like, if
great point.
There was a state of shock for me where it was like I lost my fingers, but I wasn't allowing myself to feel the other pain. If you feel the physical pain and you kind of just allow yourself to feel that, you don't feel the emotional pain, you don't feel the mental pain, because you kind of quarantine and block that off for itself. But then when you actually let yourself go through the range of emotions, and you're depressed and you're anxious and you're having panic attacks and you're going through all that stuff, you're like, okay, like, now I can kind of move through that, because there's the cover's off now. Like,
yeah.
I don't have anything else to hide. Now, there's some other mental work that I have to go do. Like, I go to therapy and do all that stuff, just because I don't think everybody's equipped to handle their own situation. Sometimes you need outside counsel, whether that's professional or it's help from friends that you could be transparent with and say, hey, brother to brother, sister to sister, I'm struggling in this particular area. I need real help.
Yeah.
And as I started to do that, I started to realize, okay, now I'm in a place to where I can consciously move forward versus pretending I'm okay and just moving forward and having other trauma that is going to manifest itself.
Do you think that advice to kind of accept it and kind of, like, feel, it resonated with you because of studying psychology?
What's crazy is you don't, the people that would give the best advice don't even take their own advice.
That's funny. That's true, so, though, man. That's true.
Like, even though I knew, you know, at some level, just like human nature and everything, at not one point did I even process the ability to self-diagnose or self-heal, you know?
Like, yeah.
It was one of those things where just I wasn't myself.
Yeah.
And I could pretend that I was, but I wasn't myself. Like, I could fake it with a smile.
Yeah.
I could function at a high level and just hide it, but I wasn't myself. And until I could get back to myself, I knew it was always going to be a problem.
So you work through this, right? And like you said, still talk to people, have to kind of mentally just stay sharp and kind of, like, express things. What do you do after this? So you get the surgeries, you said 12?
Yeah, 12 surgeries.
Okay. Now, in the middle of this, you're also trying to figure out what the next move is in life. So you're kind of weighing two heavy things at the same time. What do you start, once you kind of get kind of your bearings back, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you thinking, what's my next career move? Are you thinking this is something that I'm going to take and is going to define me in a greater way? You know, because you always hear people talk about like these really unbelievable life-changing or traumatic moments, but it's almost like when their life starts for them and it gives them clarity or points them in the direction of what they want to or should be doing, and the universe is kind of guiding them there.
You know, it's crazy. Two parts to that. The first part is people already know what they want to like become. They just either life influences or somebody else recommended it or something's comfortable or they don't want to go through whatever it is it takes to get to actually what it is.
Yeah.
They already know. Like, your interests really don't change. You may be exposed to certain things and you develop new interests, but you're always going to like sports. You're always going to like food. You're always going to like a certain type of music. Like, these things are just who you are. It's in your DNA. But I think when life happens to you and you realize that there's nothing that I would go through that will be as traumatic as that, what's the downside of pursuing the thing that I actually want to do?
True.
And I think that's where people find themselves. Sometimes you may have a life event to where, like, you know, somebody's attracted to a certain cause, but the way that it manifests itself, either in their philanthropic efforts or the thing that they create, that underlying interest was always there. They just never used it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what happened for me, to where the work that I do now is like a blend of psychology and wanting to help people professionally, in being able to rely on certain background experiences that I have. Like, that's always been there. It's always been fundamental to me. How it's manifesting itself now is just a little bit different.
Yeah. You know, it's a great point you bring up, though, because you hear all the time, like, if somebody's family member or a friend passes away or gets sick, you have these regrets, or I wish I would have done this. And it takes a really traumatic experience for us to say, I should have done it this way, versus us doing it when we have the time to do it. But I think you're absolutely right, is that we have too many outside influences, too many things that are uncomfortable, too many things that are easier just to say, well, I'll do it another time, or I'll do it tomorrow. I mean, I had a friend of mine tell me, you know, littlest things. It could be like just putting away a dish. Well, I'll do it later. And he said one day, you know what? No, I'm going to do it right now. Because if I can start with this, I'll do it with everything that I kind of want to do. But we all work out physically. I feel like mentally is where a lot of people lack or don't invest the time and energy. So it sounds like this kind of was something that you took. You kind of got a lot of clarity from it. And now you're taking this experience, childhood experience, where you're like, hey, I loved community, being around people, sports, performing at the highest level. And this has led to kind of what you're doing now, which is kind of, can you kind of give an overview or an insight to what that is?
So it's really change management work. And it functions under like the company's vessel. And it's really like, how do you transport people from where they are right now to another part, to where they want to be? And a lot of that is like, what are you trying to accomplish? What are you aligned to? Who are the people that you are going to join forces with to make this happen? What are the experiences that you need to make it to wherever you're trying to go? Because just because you want to do something doesn't mean that you have all the resources at the time. Those still have to be developed. You don't go from amateur to pro just because you're like, oh, you know, I think this would be really cool. There's a lot of stuff that has to bridge the gap in between there and get people to understand. Like, if you're trying to go on this journey, it's going to take a lot for you to get there, but it's definitely possible for you to get there.
And I mean, some of the clients you're working with, I mean, you've had kind of this consultancy management for how long now?
So it came, the accident occurred April 2017. It was about a year and a half, probably like a year of just kind of like figuring life out, like detaching and getting my mental health and all that
stuff.
And then that's when I probably started to move into it, like May of last year, you know, where it's just like, okay, this is a real thing now. I want to make sure I can drive value.
And I only bring that up that it's been a short period, because even in such a short period, you've made quite an impact. I mean, some of the brands that you've worked with, you just want to kind of mention real quick. I mean, these are some world-renowned brands.
I mean, I was working with Randstad, which is a global staffing agency, on Wednesday. I've done things with Cushman & Wakefield. I've done things with PwC. I've done things with Southern Company, Home Depot. So it's, you know, I've been...
So blessed. Small companies.
Yeah, no. So I've definitely been blessed, you know, but I think it's, once you find like that true North Star, and or you realign to a North Star, it helps you not think about what happened, because you've dealt with what happened. You can't change what happened. You're in a good place about what happened. Now you just can't stay in that place. You got to like figure out life is about constant motion. So you put your target on something else, and then you start to go after that, and then you develop whatever you need to get there. So part of that journey was, okay, like I want to continue to increase my business acumen. Harvard has a program that functions as their executive MBA. I enrolled in that and completed that. You know, now I get a chance to become a Harvard alum, you know, and then you understand what you're actually trying to accomplish better. So you're able to drive greater value. So it's like, okay, you actually want to talk to this person because they actually help solve a real problem for me.
Yeah.
Next fall, crazy enough, I'll be starting my master's in organizational design, IO psychology, because it's not just to have the title. It's like, okay, fundamentally, how do I continue to enhance this person's experience?
Yeah.
And then after that, there may be something else that I come across. It's like, okay, a person had this problem right there. I want to be able to solve that. Maybe I need to go do something. And it doesn't always look like titles and degrees. Maybe it's, okay, this particular person, they're having a diversity issue. What's the most diverse place that I can go to, you know, put myself in that environment to learn? So the constant evolution of my personal experiences to be able to help somebody else in their personal experience that has a real value add to whatever they're trying to accomplish in the business context is what I'm really excited about.
I'll tell you, it's so interesting that, you know, we talked when you were going through high school and the struggle in a sense, or even in college, where education was balancing with sports, right? Like, mm-hmm. and now here you are back in the education realm in a lot of ways. And there was a reason why you were so kind of honed in on the educational aspect. It's kind of cool to see you come full circle. But, you know, people always talk, and this is why I love to hear people like yourself speak. Accident, all that aside, everybody says, I don't have time, I'll do it later, or I can't do this, or I'm too busy. That is complete bullshit, because 100%. In a matter of like a year and a half, 2 years,
100%.
You have built out a company, gone to Harvard Business School, going to get another master's, speaking to these groups, and overcoming a traumatic incident, and you're still going.
Yeah.
And you can honestly, in all fairness, stop right now, market it as like, I was an ex-NFL player who had an accident, who now I'm motivating people. But that is not, you're not like settling on a gimmick or kind of like, this is how I'm marketing it. Mm. You are really living it. You're constantly educating yourself, going back, performing at the highest level. You're really doing it. So I think a lot of times people go into these companies as motivational speakers or consultants or however you want to phrase it, and they're selling something, but they haven't really done it themselves. You're actually living it. Yeah. And you're going through it as you're teaching it. So what better way to kind of tell people than say, I'm actually improving myself daily. I'm showing you. And you know, what's what I love about you, man, I the first time I met you, your energy was amazing, but I honestly, I never even think to myself about the hand accident. Like it doesn't, to me, like that isn't you. Like it doesn't even like, sometimes I'll see you talk about it and I'll like, oh yeah. But that's when you see that you're doing something impressive and that like just who you are as a person outweighs the hand defining you.
Yeah.
And I think more than none, I'm sure people, and maybe it's just me, but I feel pretty confident in this. People probably see the hand for the first time because I thought it was a cast like we spoke about.
Yeah.
I mean, apparently it's some unbelievable technology that you're mentioning, but it starts for a second. You see it, you're like, okay. But after like 5 minutes of speaking to you,
it's just like,
I would never even look at it and be like, you know, your hand has this thing on it.
Like, how do you define yourself? Like, am I going to define myself as, you know, a former athlete? Am I going to define myself as an amputee? How am I going to define myself? You know, and I don't like box myself into any of those categories.
I love that though. Like even when we talk, you don't say I'm an ex NFL player or I'm an ex this or I'm an ex that. You're just you.
I'm just me. I'm trying to be like the best.
I love that though, man.
Of myself, and I think, and that's why I think like you have to align to something. If you don't align to something, you're either stuck in the past, or you're wasting time trying to like figure out like, and that's why like I think you have to get involved in something so for that moment in time you could be aligned, and then if it doesn't work, then you understand, okay, I need to align to something else. But you can't just stay in this place of confusion because it's unproductive. And then I also think everybody's inspired by something.
Yeah,
it's like people are gravitated towards something. So I think it would be irresponsible for somebody trying to come in and inspire somebody, because somebody may be inspired by something, they may not. They may be inspired by something that's completely unrelated. And it's hard to motivate people for things that they don't want to do. Like, nobody has to motivate you to eat. Nobody has to motivate you to take care of your daughter. Nobody has to motivate you. So motivation to me is just like this weird thing, because I've never like needed somebody to motivate me. So I don't even know how to, I can help you in an area that like I know you're trying to accomplish. Like, okay, you're trying to get better at route running. Let's go find somebody that can actually help you route run. But if I have to motivate you to route run, then it's like, you probably don't even want to do it anyway. Like,
yeah.
You know, like,
it's a good way to look at it, man. That's a good, you know, because you see a lot of these things where people, you know, listen to podcasts, they read books, self-help, but you have to want to do it. And it seems like a lot of people speak or talk words.
Yeah.
You actually show execution.
Yeah. Like what are you fundamentally trying to accomplish, and how do we get there? If you want to come in, like literally I've had opportunities that I've had to turn down just because they would be off brand, where it's like, hey, I want you to come in and motivate my team. And like, I'm not the guy for you. Like, cause I'm not going to motivate you. Like, I don't know what to tell you to get you to get where you want.
You're like,
to
I'm running a, you're running a business. Yeah. You're showing people, you're managing people and showing them how to go from A to Z and execute.
Yes. You know, like that's where I want to help you at. If you want a motivational talk, I've heard some people that like will get you fired up out of your seat. I don't know what the result is going to be.
But that's going to say, you may leave that talk, be like, I'm going to change the world. I'm going to go write in a journal. I'm going to do this. And 2 days later, you're back to the same shit.
You don't know what to do. Like, I remember.
Nobody's holding him accountable.
Nobody's holding him accountable. When I was a rookie in Cleveland, you're talented, but you don't know what to do. So while somebody's like, hey, you know, work harder, work harder, work harder, how am I actually supposed to work harder? Like, how am I supposed to study?
It's a great point.
Like, how am I supposed to actually execute on that? So the motivation to do without the strategy behind it, without the purpose behind it, without the know-how, is just kind of, is probably more frustrating than anything, because you have this all this pent-up stuff within you and you don't know how to execute on it.
Yeah. Man, this is wild. Super cool. So, you know, you're going back, like you said, to get your master's. You're going to keep on talking to companies, continually evolve. What's kind of next for yourself in the business?
So the business is talking is how some things manifest themselves, but within a lot of that is really like looking at the inner workings of the organization, doing discovery with them, and like literally helping them figure out how to put this stuff in. So a talk is almost, I don't define it as talking, because you're, it's like a culmination of like these different ways to get the whatever the end objective is. Sometimes it's talking, sometimes it's workshops, sometimes it's individual stuff one-on-one, sometimes it's going through strategy and writing stuff down, whiteboard and stuff. So it's a range of things to get to whatever the objective is.
So initially you go in for the first part, but that's just a small piece of the full equation that you're trying to achieve.
It's a small piece, and it started out as talking, because somebody would say, hey, I want to bring you in, you know, tell us about your experience. And after you do that a couple of times, then you ask the person like, okay, like, what are you actually trying to accomplish here?
Yeah.
Hey, we have to redo our whole IT department and people are resistant to change for this XYZ reason. Okay. That's a little bit different than motivation. Hey, what are you trying to accomplish? Hey, our business model is fundamentally changing and we're getting pressure from over here, da 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 da. Okay, you don't really need motivation over here. Like, this is what you're kind of trying to accomplish. So the talk is more so outlining like how these things flow within the confines of what they need, versus just a random story that might, you know, get them charged up for 30 seconds and then have them go back to wherever they're going.
Why do you think it's so important to you to see people succeed? There's something in you that's making you want to do this.
I mean, I've had tremendous help along the way. You know, I think it's just really paying it forward, you know, from, gosh, you did. We'd be here for years trying to, you know, help all the people that have just helped me just out of the goodness of their heart, you know, not wanting anything back. And the ability to, you know, see somebody function at whatever the highest level of their God-given ability is exciting, because in a weird way, that's like kind of how like my life functions. Like, my friends that are functioning at a high level, they're pushing me to do something at a high level. I'm pushing them to do it at a high level. And if they set a new standard, the joy of now having another target that the whole group should eventually push up to. And I think a lot of times people will see somebody have success and they're jealous or they envy, versus saying, oh, now like I should be able to take my God given an ability to function at that level. And that's just the excitement of it.
Man, I love it. So, you know, if you weren't have had the accident, do you think you would have been in the same place, or just it would have taken a little longer to get there?
What's crazy is that I had started to talk to like friends and family about, hey, you know, like this is kind of how I'm feeling here.
Okay.
I knew it was coming. Like whether it would have been another 6 months or a year, it was coming to make that transition out of, because I would interact with certain people and they'd have a different set of challenges than what we could provide on our platform. And it's like, God, I want to help you solve that, but there's a conflict of interest here. So I wouldn't be able to help you solve that because, you know, there's guidelines and regulations and all that other stuff. So this like tug of war, this tension was there. And I was like, man, I don't know what this looks like in what I'm trying to create now. And even now, a lot of times we're like, you talk to people and they're like, we're looking for that, but how do you define that? And it's still part of the journey of defining it, but the work hopefully speaks for itself to where,
I mean,
the results there.
it's a wild journey, man. I'll tell you that. So, you know, for those that, you know, want to learn more about you or the company, kind of where can they go, where they can find information, all that good stuff.
So it's, the company's called The Vessel, and the Vessel is THEVESSOL. Vessel is spelled a little bit different just so we can have some ownership.
There you go. Trademark.
Trademark. I still got to get that lawyer too. But yeah, and all my social media handles are Iron Massaqua. Just, you know, I've kind of taken on the whole Iron Man moniker with this.
Love it, man.
This is more Tony Stark's than, you know, just...
Listen, man, Tony Stark's is badass.
Tony Stark's a badass.
So, you know.
Hopefully they bring him back.
We'll see. Otherwise, you're going to have to step in for Tony.
I might.
That'd be pretty amazing, man. Could you imagine that?
It would.
Listen, the way your life goes and you what you've accomplished, who knows? You may just do it.
Yeah, my wife would be like, you're going where?
So, man, listen, I want to, you know, one thing I always like to do is, one, appreciate you coming on today, sharing the story. Two, I always like to leave people with something, if there's one thing that they could kind of walk away with today that they'll remember this interview for, or say, this is something that motivated me, and I say motivated lightly.
Yeah.
What is that thing that you would say?
I mean, I would probably say, you know, move through life like you know God's trying to bless you. You know, I think that, you know, we all have a purpose here. We all have something that we're uniquely qualified to do at a high level. And that doesn't mean that it happens overnight. It doesn't mean that, and I'm not even talking like monetarily. I'm just thinking like your purpose, whether that's being a great parent and that's the thing that you want to do, or starting a business, or, you know, working your way up the corporate ladder. It's taking care of yourself, it's eating right, it's, you know, whatever your thing is that you're supposed to do, like move through it like you know like God has blessed you to do that at a super high level.
Love it, man. Yeah. Love it. Listen, I want to see you continue winning. You're just
likewise
just
bro.
A good person, man. It's nice to see. Forget all the accolades and all that, but continued success, man. And I appreciate you coming on today.
Likewise, anytime.
Definitely. Once again, I'm your host, Justin Epstein, and thank you for listening to Culturation. As always, this show has been powered by Premiere.